Thank you, Kendrick, for asking me to give a talk. And I should apologize because I was up until 4 in the morning. And also, I think this talk was finished just like 5 minutes ago. So not everything might be in place. I'm not quite sure, but somehow whenever I want to give a new talk, I'm asked to give a talk, I want to give a new one. And so I want you guys to hear something new, something you hadn't heard before. So, surprise. Okay, don't hesitate to interrupt me, obviously, I shouldn't say that here. And let's see. So I'm gonna talk about a few different topics, but then I'm gonna motivate how they are related to each other. Hopefully that's going to be, basically the plan or my goal by the end of this talk is to convince you that there is more connection between black holes and Big Bang than you might have imagined. Of course, I mean, another way to think about it is that if you eat somewhere called Black Hole Bistro every day for 7 years, then you would see black holes everywhere. And that's another way to interpret the content of this talk. Okay. So this is, the past few years have seen a renaissance of general relativity. Both fields of black hole astrophysics and Big Bang cosmology have become mainstream, well-established scientific disciplines with lots of data and lots of successes. One of these is a little bit more established than the other, but I'm not going to name names. So you might guess based on my background, which one I think is a bit more established. But nevertheless, you can see, so on the left you have observations of observations or upcoming observations of black holes so on the left, this is hopefully somewhat ambitious image that our friend next door, well, actually his office is just down the corridor, Avery Broderick is gonna make out of black holes at the black hole at the center of our galaxy through the Event Horizon Telescope. This is one of the state-of-the-art simulations of accretion onto black holes. And this is one of the several attempts or several successful attempts to fit the radiation, the spectrum, energy spectrum of emission from black holes. There are points here and there are lines that go through them, but you can hardly distinguish them from each other because the models are actually very successful in explaining the data. On the right, we have a very different scale, a very different regime. Cosmology, so this is larger scale galaxy distribution from SDSS and more modern surveys, WMAP and now Planck, and they have also been extremely successful. What you can see is here the data from various CMB experiments. This is the power spectrum. So this was the energy power spectrum. This is the angular power spectrum, but they basically do the same thing. They look at energy as a function of a scale, or fluctuations as the function of a scale. And you see that the points from the data and the line that goes through them are indistinguishable. So these are both very successful, as you can see. Of course, there are discrepancies, there are anomalies in both of them. And what they have in common is that they are both testing the limits of general relativity. And that's the theme of this talk, that both these scenarios, we are in fact seeing general relativity in its full glory. And in fact, the fact that they exist, they also signal the fact that signal that general relativity must be failing at some point, either at the middle of these black holes or at the boundaries of our cosmological observations. Well, I mean, here you're just saying that it must be a big bang at some point. That's right. And here is a singularity. So both contain a singularity.
But strictly speaking, the singularity we don't get do not tell us the same thing.
No, I'm not saying we're not saying it. I'm saying that they imply, so it's not, we're not actually observing. Now, maybe we will observe the failure of general relativity, but that's certainly one thing that's for sure is that we are in the regime of full-fledged general relativity in both these situations. Now, In both these subfields of astrophysics, sky is the limit. Now, what is the sky in this case? In the case of cosmology, we have a horizon. We have, emitectically, photons don't get farther than the last scattering surface. You might hope to see neutrinos or gravitational waves that go a little bit farther. But basically, there is a surface of infinite redshift, which coincides with Big Bang, in fact. And the same is true for black holes. There is a surface of infinite redshift that we call event horizon. And based on at least the standard laws of physics, it's impossible for us to probe beyond either of these surfaces. Now, of course, the definition of redshift is not a covariant definition of general relativity unless you define preferred frames. And in this case, one of the preferred frames is us as an observer. Here we are sitting at the center of the universe. And here we're sitting far from the black hole. But then we have to decide what the other observer is. And that's where the controversy is, as we're going to come back to. In the case of cosmology, there is somewhat of a consensus that there is a preferred observer. There's a cosmological frame. Universe is homogeneous in that frame. So the redshift, the cosmological redshift, is not that controversial. In the case of black hole, it's something that's much harder to pin down. There is a preferred frame in a black hole defined by its Killing vectors, by its Killing vector. The fact that, okay, it has a spherical symmetry, but also it has time symmetry. So that defines a preferred observer. However, most people think, at least traditionally, people don't think that is a physical observer. A physical observer doesn't sit still in the frame of the black hole, will be falling into a black hole. So a physical observer who is not held by very strong ropes might fall into in either case, though, you do see an infinite redshift. So the infinite redshift case is a ubiquitous feature, and that's the fact that you cannot see, numerous end of the fact that you cannot see beyond the horizon of the black hole. Of course, there are differences between these infinite redshift surfaces. In the case of Big Bang, we think the curvature is divergent. However, the curvature of space-time here, at least based on the traditional view of black holes, is finite at the horizon. That's why people haven't really pushed, at least until very recently, people haven't really pushed this analogy between these two surfaces very far, because apart from the fact that they are infinite redshift, locally they look very, very different. Of course, the other difference is that this space-time enjoys more symmetry than this. So the thesis I'm going to try to push through different lines of evidence, lines of argument in this talk, is that maybe there is more similarity between black hole horizons and Big Bang than we've ever imagined. So here's the outline of this talk. So there are three different themes that's all connected to each other. I'm going to first talk by way of introduction about firewalls and motivations and why people have started thinking about them. Then I'm going to try to connect firewalls to Big Bang and how you could actually, what is the logical or logical link that connect these two in a more quantitative or precise way than what I've already said. And then finally, I'm going to talk about a somewhat different way of connecting black holes and Big Bang through a holographic description. Okay? And as I mentioned, don't hesitate to interrupt me. Let's just start with firewalls. This is the best picture of firewall I've ever seen so far on the internet. And the trick is not to search for firewall, search for wall of fire. That's how you're going to search, get this. So what are they?
Legally, the firewall in this building is a wall that does not catch fire. It's called a firewall.
Is that right?
That's true. Right?
Legally, I think.
Legally.
In building codes.
I see.
Fire doors, yes.
But even properly, it can resist catching fire.
Yeah, are resistant to fire.
Is that called a firewall? Is it called like fire-resistant wall or something?
I
see. I always thought about like computer, like antivirus softwares and things like that. So,
no,
Right. Actually, I don't have too much material. So what are the motivations for thinking that the space-time, the classical space, but when I talk about the space-time, I mean the classical space-time might end at the horizon. Of course, everybody thinks that classical physics breaks down at the singularity. More controversial is that the classical space-time might break down at the horizon. So the oldest one is the so-called information paradox. Of course, information paradox is a paradox. It doesn't actually tell you something. It just tells you there's something wrong. And what could be wrong is up to interpretation. And this has been first brought up by basically Hawking himself when he discussed evaporation of black holes. This was in the 70s, and this is various people worked on it and commented on it. Most recently, it was revived by Almeri, Marl, Polchinski, and Soli in 2013, and then they coined this new term, firewall, which I guess up until then had different applications, you just learned. So what is the statement? And this has been stated in different ways by different people, that the statement is that unitary black hole evaporation is not consistent with local physics plus a smooth horizon. So that's pretty uncontroversial, although, I mean, whoever I've talked to agreed with this. To be frank, from my point of view, these arguments sound more like a spiritual argument than because we don't actually know the theory of quantum gravity. But nevertheless, this seems pretty controversial. How to get out of it has been different by different people. Some people decide unitarity is not the way to go. Some people decide that okay, quantum gravity is not local, so that's fine. We already knew that. But then I think the more recent point of view is that maybe we should just give up the notion of a smooth horizon. And of course, that's been kind of ingrained in our teaching or in our education of general relativity. Everybody has told us since we were kids in kindergarten that horizons are smooth. Nothing happens at the horizon. Okay. So this is maybe this is to blame, the smooth horizon. So what are the other arguments? Another argument is that, in fact, the idea of a semi-classical gravity is a local notion, but quantum gravity is not a local theory. So we think in here, in this room, the curvature is much smaller than Planck curvature, so quantum gravity effects may not be important. But as I said, we know, and we can talk to our quantum gravity colleagues down the corridor or down the stairs, that quantum gravity theory is not local, so there couldn't be a local criterion for whether quantum gravity is important or not, if you want to be rigorous.
Some of us might say that it's essentially local, but it may very well be local except in a essential, except in a trivial sense.
Well, okay. So you're saying it's essentially local, that's what you're saying.
So aside from, you know, talking about extended objects.
Well, but I mean, that I think that's not locality. I would call that.
It's kind of trivial.
I don't think that's true. Yeah. Okay. So now I think. Well, anyway. So that's. But I guess I'm talking about something very specific now. So you can think about tunneling effect, and there is no semi-classical notion of tunneling. Tunneling is quantum mechanical transition from one classical solution to another classical solution that's far away, and you cannot actually quantify that in a local way. So that's, however, we don't usually worry about that because the rate of that is exponentially suppressed. This is usually suppressed by exponential of the Euclidean action. So big objects, classical, that's the law, right? And for a big black hole, this is huge. The entropy of black hole, or the black hole is big, as an astrophysical black hole. So this exponential is tiny. However, there is something else we know about black holes, if you believe in Bekenstein and Hawking and string theorists. That black holes have big entropy. In fact, they have the biggest entropy than anything else we know in the universe. And the tunneling rate, there might be a small tunneling rate to tunnel to one of the microstates of the black hole, but there are many, many of these microstates. And as it turns out, by a stroke of magic, this product is one. So the exponential of minus tunneling rate, where this is the Euclidean action, a proxy for the tunneling rate, and times the exponential of entropy, these two exactly cancel each other. And that says that if you have something at the size of a black hole, the quantum tunneling is not exponentially suppressed. Now, there could be a parallel suppression, so it may not be as fast as you would mind, but the usual argument that we have that big objects are classical doesn't work because of the entropy. Well, it could be, so the idea is tunneling from one quantum state to another quantum state, or sorry, one semi-classical state to another semi-classical state. Now, the idea is that you have one semi-classical state, which is, say, you have a star that's collapsing, but a black hole has e to the area over 4 not microstates. So in principle, you don't have to actually smoothly transition from one state to another. Quantum mechanics allow for transition from any state to any other state. And however, this is usually suppressed by this exponential. So yeah, so this could be from transition from a semi-classical state where we start from to any other microstate.
So you had a strong statement. You said that these exactly cancel, but as far as I know, nobody's ever actually written down.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you cannot actually do this calculation if you know until you know the full theory of quantum gravity.
You take the mass as a measure of the energy, you multiply it by the mass as a measure of the time, you get the area. So then Gendrick, you tunnel between your favorite quantum states.
No, it's important that this must be something the size of a black hole. Like, if you do this calculation, but it's chair, and you see that it is actually, there is no cancellation. So it's important that it should be a size of a black hole. If it's bigger, there is no cancellation. And I mean, this cancellation is only at the level of exponential. There could be parallels that are still much smaller. So that we cannot actually do until we know the full theory of quantum gravity. Yes?
It's also, there is an implicit assumption here that you can resolve all of these exponentially in many states. And that's not absolutely not clear that you can do.
Well,
so in other words, what I'm trying to do,
yeah,
when you talk about quantum tunneling, that sort of an almost implicit assumption that you tunnel from a given state.
That's
the
right.
The thing is that it's like almost impossible, if you have that many states,
mm-hmm,
to actually prepare your system, you know, in a specific state. You usually end up preparing it in a mixed state.
Okay, why would that suppress the tunneling, right?
I'm not saying it's like in a mixed state. So if I am in a superposition of states already,
yeah,
what do you mean I am tunneling?
You could have still, so tunneling is a semi-classical description. So if I'm doing full-fledged quantum mechanics, I'm not talking about tunneling, I'm just talking about transition rates. But I think there is this notion that black hole is big, it's a classical object, you shouldn't worry about tunneling. And here I'm saying that that's not obvious.
No, and I'm saying you shouldn't. I agree with that statement.
Okay.
The reason for that is because if you look at a very highly excited state, even though you would think that those are distinct states,
mm-hmm,
and it makes sense to talk about transitions between them. In fact, there have been a lot of work with
people
showing that those very high energy states are actually almost indistinguishable.
I agree with you. I completely agree with you. Yes.
Then,
no, I think that's right.
It's not okay. Then you can.
I'm not.
What you're saying is that in fact quantum tunneling is happening all the time, and I guess he's saying the black hole is already quantum.
No, I'm not saying that.
Because
okay.
I'm saying that, you know, for me to tunnel into something, I need to figure out that I can prepare my system in that something, and I'm saying it's very, very difficult to do it.
You agree that a collapsing star is in a tiny, tiny subset of the potential states that the black hole can be, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the entropy of the star is much, much lower. So then that means that we have in a collapsing star a very carefully and specially prepared initial condition.
I'm not sure I agree with that. So there has been, you know, we can talk more, but Nayesh knows works it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's the work by Vijay Balasubramanian and others where they actually showed that highly excited states, and particularly in the larger limits, even though you think of it as a pure state.
But I don't see the connection between these two. I mean, you could have a mixed state and still talk about tunneling.
I'm just saying that your statement implies,
mm-hmm,
that there are quantum effects, that I should see quantum effects when I have a large object.
I didn't say large object. I'm saying if you have a large black hole.
A large black hole, large object, right? It has a very small tunneling rate, but it has a high degeneracy of states, and that's why you basically argue,
mm-hmm,
that you should see quantum effect.
Right.
That's what I am.
I see. So you're saying
I disagree with that, and the reason why I disagree with that is because that argument implies that you actually can isolate the states and you can think about them.
I see what you're saying.
And I'm saying that you can't.
Okay.
For
so you're saying
like a black hole.
Okay. So you think then there is no cancellation? Is that what you're
saying? Not a cancellation. That thing doesn't.
Okay. So this is not an exact argument.
Yeah.
But
X minus ES. I'm not sure what that would mean.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying. I think a lot of us regard this as a rather fuzzy argument. I don't think it has an honest calculation. A lot of us, aside from me.
I mean this is the fuzz, but these are all fuzzy arguments.
I wouldn't make that slander, but okay, you get it, you like. But also, if you do want to do that, and just to grab home for you, you might very well ask if I believe there's entropy associated with the cosmological horizon. Surely I should say the same thing, which would lead us to disaster.
That's a different discussion. That's a different discussion.
I think that argument is simpler than that. So like Masur just points out that you can call it Euclidean algebra. The easiest thing you could put in this is the same number and the same answer is, if you take mc squared of the black hole, okay, that's an energy, that's an E. Let's take Boltzmann's factors as M, it says delta E over kt is a Boltzmann factor. And since you have mc squared, just ask, you know, if what's the chance of my black hole looking totally different from what I thought it looked like, and what's the chance of it being square instead of round or something, right? That's put in a delta E, which is order mc squared, you divide by kt, for which you plug in the Hawking temperature, and that number happens to be minus sc, which is about 10 to the 100. So you've got e to the minus 10 to the plus 100 is the thing on the left, and that's just saying, you know, how well can I ever compare this Legrand state, or how good is the zero temperature description, and the answer is it's not obviously good. I think that's all these guys are saying. There's no microphysics involved in that statement, really.
You're saying that, I'm talking about quantum tunneling here.
I know, it's the same number. Quantum tunneling has the same action of...
As long as you agree with the same conclusion.
It's the same number, that goes into both. Okay. And because Euclidean action happens to give you the Hawking temperatures, it's the same...
Right, so this happens to be identical. Our Euclidean action for a black hole is the same as entropy for the black hole. That's why there's a cancellation. Okay, so let's move on. So none of these is supposed to convince you that something is happening at the horizon. These are all motivations or suggestive. So another suggestive observation was by Samir Matur, who basically devised basically this classical horizonless space-times that are higher dimensional, have lots of ergo regions, and the idea is that, in fact, if you count how many of them you have, you can actually account for black hole entropy without actually having a horizon. And he was claiming that these fuzzballs, which are these classical solutions, in fact, are the microstates of certain types of black holes.
Probably should put a hopefully in parentheses.
Okay. Well, as I said, these are none of these are supposed to convince you. These are like different motivations. So the last one, and this is actually how I got me started in this. So I guess I'm a little bit biased towards it, but I actually noticed that if you put dark energy in equilibrium with a stellar black hole firewall, and it wasn't called firewall when I worked on it, this was in 2009, but it's basically something that's a black hole which has a surface, and the surface has Planckian density or Planckian size, then in fact that gives you a scale of dark energy without any fine tuning. And that doesn't prove anything, but it's kind of suggestive that if you can build a consistent model which has dark energy interacting with the firewall, with quantum gravity scales, then you don't have to fine tune the scale of dark energy, it could actually explain it. So none of this is, as I said, none of this is supposed to be rigorous, but they all point to the same thing. So, what do we do in physics when logic fails? We go to the labs. So, and the question is, what do the labs tell us, or what can we learn in the labs? So, this is a picture of how a firewall may look like. This is not supposed to be rigorous in any sense, but this is how a black hole looks like in general relativity, or when you make a black hole. So, this is something you can find in all the textbooks. So you have a ball of stuff, dust, or gas that collapses, forms a singularity. But before that happens, there's a horizon. There's basically the point of no return, that any signal that comes out of the surface of the star cannot reach infinity, but would also fall into the singularity. So this is a Penrose diagram for a black hole. So the idea for forming a firewall is that this is not what happened. At some point, so originally the collapse goes on as it's supposed to be, but at some point this singularity, or maybe you shouldn't call it singularity, wherever the classical gravity fails, approaches the horizon. And nobody has actually devised, forget about having a theory of calculating how this space-time looks like. But the idea is that at some point, asymptotically, the singularity, and by singularity here, I mean where quantum gravity, when classical gravity fails, approaches the horizon. And then from that point onward, and this could be a gradual or a sudden process, all the matter that falls into a black hole, in fact, falls into this firewall. And it could actually have an atmosphere. So that's something that you could, in principle, see. Of course, if you are a proper string theorist, or no, I shouldn't say that. If you try to avoid observations, you could say whatever that happens, happens inside the horizon. And so we'd never be able to observe anything. But then, I mean, nature is rarely that unkind. And we may hope to be able, if something special happens right at the horizon and we see just outside the horizon, we may hope to see something. That's an idea, that's not a prediction, that's something to go and explore. And in fact, this was done by our very own Avery, and I guess Ramesh Narayan, who is a distinguished research chair here. This was also done before they were called firewalls. I guess they were called gravastars at the time. That was a different one. Okay. Okay. So they did rule out firewalls back then before they were called firewalls, as from astrophysical point of view. But they ruled out a very specific type of firewalls. Firewalls that when the stuff falls into them, they emit light. You would think, I mean, if there's a wall of fire, it should emit lights, right? That's kind of in the name. It turns out that we would have seen that light. And the light that they would emit is less than 0.4% of the amount of light that we observe from accretion into the black hole at the center of the galaxy. So there must be some sort of conspiracy when the light, when the stuff fall into this firewall or the surface, they don't emit anything. They just go through or just get absorbed into the surface. Because if they emit a little bit of light, like less than a percent of the amount of energy that they had, then we would have seen it already. So the question, though, is could you actually, so what, one thing that we went about asking was, does it have to come out in photons? What about neutrinos? One thing we know about high-energy astrophysical processes is that core collapse supernovae emit most of their energy in neutrinos. And the reason for that is that neutrinos interact very weakly with matter. The cross-section is typically some 20 orders of magnitude less than photons. So they can escape the dense environments much more easily, and they can take energy away. If you could manage to heat them up and they can get out much more easily, then it stands to reason that maybe they would be the main agent of cooling in a very dense, thick, you know, optically thick environment. So that's a proposal, that's an idea. And furthermore, you could, now, of course, you have to assume something about the spectrum of neutrinos that are escaping. So you could either assume a thermal spectrum, or another thing we assume, and this is something you see a lot in high-energy processes, the first order Fermi acceleration, is a power law.
You're just assuming by the idea that this firewall is emitting lots of neutrinos?
So, right. So the idea is that there is a stuff falling into the black hole. So they hit the surface, okay? Or they hit the firewall. So if there's a firewall and there's stuff, if there's accretion, if there's no accretion onto it, then there's nothing, right? But if there's accretion, the stuff fall, hit the surface. And the same thing, if I throw this stick on the ground, it gains some energy, some kinetic energy. But the minute it hits the ground, it turns to thermal energy and it's radiated away. Or it hits up the environment. So this is one of the two things that happen. And what happens commonly in astrophysics, and you see this in neutrino stars, for example, when there's accretion onto neutrino stars, then you see light coming out of the surface. So here is the thing, same thing, and that's with the same assumption that was done here. Something hits the surface, it heats up the surface, so there will be light coming out. Now, I guess what we're adding to this is that if this is an optically thick environment, it doesn't have to be light, it could be neutrinos. The amount of neutrinos would be some fraction of the accretion onto the black hole / firewall. So this is so the calculation that my student Yasaman has done, and if you can go through this, calculate or estimate how much accretion there is into astrophysical black holes throughout the universe. It turns out that if you assume a thermal spectrum, then this would be very, very low energy neutrinos. You wouldn't be able to see them. But as it turns out, and it's kind of interesting, that if you assume that you have a Fermi acceleration type mechanism that gives you a power law like this, you could, in fact, fit the observations of ultra-high energy neutrinos that, or so-called PEB neutrinos that have been recently observed by the IceCube collaboration. So it just happens that their scale is the same. There are some free parameters. So there is an epsilon, which is the efficiency, so how much you convert, how much of the accretion you convert into neutrinos. Yes?
I don't understand this part at all.
OK. Sure. Right. So this plot is the spectrum of neutrinos, or the energy spectrum of neutrinos that are observed by various experiments and then different theories. So this is just the flux of neutrinos per energy. This is the energy. And this goes from 10 GeV to 10 to the 9 GeV. So these points are observations from AMANDA, and these are mostly atmospheric neutrinos. We know that, so they're very well fit for atmospheric neutrinos. And the bow tie here is observations of IceCube for ultra-high energy or PEV neutrinos. And these ones, we believe that these don't have an atmospheric origin. The atmospheric flux just goes down. So this is, I think these are real cosmogenic neutrinos.
The AGN curve is like way above that.
Okay, so these are predictions before the data came out. So I'm sure if the authors of these papers go back, they could tweak the parameters of the model to basically make this fit, maybe.
Which one are the theoretical?
Okay, so there is a prediction for what you might get from active galactic nuclei, this curve. Is a prediction for what you might get for gamma ray bursts. Is, I guess, this lower one. These are a standard astrophysical phenomena. And these two thick bands is what we predict you might get from the firewalls, or if there is emission from the surface of the firewall.
Shouldn't you combine all of them?
No, these are different. You mean add them up? Is that what you're saying? OK, right. So that would be, if you believe all of them were correct, then you would add them up. But then there are free parameters in all of them. So you can add them up in your mind if you want. Remember that these are, this is logarithmic scale. So this is like three orders of magnitude. So if I just add these three curves, then it's really just the biggest one that matters. So adding them up doesn't really make too much of a difference.
This plot would seem to be telling me where are all the AGN neutrinos going? Why aren't we seeing them? We don't understand AGN.
Why do we understand?
I mean, just looking at this, it says IceCube's only seen that blue bit. AGN predict this. Missing neutrinos.
Yeah.
Or we don't understand
AGN. I think that's certainly true. I mean, that's certainly a conclusion you can draw from this. I mean, you don't really need this to draw that conclusion. Yeah. There are lots of uncertainties about understanding AGN. So I guess you could go back to the first slide I had that we understand. Yes, there are lots of things we don't understand about black holes. So the status of precision black hole physics is not quite the same as precision cosmology.
That's not even what goes into the AGN line, right? Isn't this the sort of thing that Stecker and company did where they just say some fraction of the energy in the equation just goes into cosmic rays?
Right, right.
Why? How?
These are very ad hoc.
Right? So, I mean,
these are very ad hoc models.
Neutrinos were missing based on that, right?
Okay.
That
seems to be like arbitrary set of assumptions.
These are kind of.
They're not unreasonable guesses, but they're all guesses.
Yeah. So, yeah, so I think 20 years ago, most of astrophysics looked like this. But then, like, cosmology came along, and then a lot of people got spoiled, and they wanted, like, reduced chi squared of one, and basically, going through the error bars. But but it turns out that, yeah, most of astrophysics still is like this. Curves miss data.
Historically, astrophysics is all about fitting spectra, and you can do that exceedingly well. Put precision cosmology to shame.
Are you saying that this is exceedingly well fit? No. Yeah.
So the points are upper bounds?
Well, in a sense, they are. Yeah, I guess we should have kept. So there is these are mostly atmospheric neutrinos here. So this doesn't, yeah. So this doesn't actually rule out any of these models, just that the atmospheric neutrinos dominate here. So,
and the parameters for written on more black holes are chosen so that you can fit the data?
No, there is no. From galaxy formation models, those are known. So the only thing that's free here is efficiency of conversion of accretion into neutrinos, and that's this epsilon parameter. And so the thing is that if you have, depending on the power, this power, epsilons of over there, depending on this power, I mean how close to two is, you could have efficiency of from 40% to 0.1% that would fit the data. But you can consider this as an upper bound, as if you think these other astrophysical methods could fit the data, or you could consider this as a possible. But I think a more conservative interpretation is that this is really an upper bound on efficiency of convergence to neutrinos.
So what's the picture here? So if you have a firewall, the Fermi acceleration is a moving Miller effect. Is that you trap charged particles?
The proposal is that it could also work with neutral particles. So, and I mean, go through the math that it could. I mean, it doesn't have to. And then there are accretion shocks. If there is stuff falling into a surface, there would be an accretion shock.
That optically thick neutrinos. I mean, that's for Fermi to
that's
work.
That's right.
Fermi
it's optically
thick.
Absolutely. It's
so
optically thick
so
neutrinos.
You want a plasma above the firewall to be moving in. And compressing, and optically thick to neutrinos, that the neutrinos can circulate inside.
That's right.
And then escape, and that this thing has to have a thickness which is actually macro copy. We're not talking about a Planck maxi. We're talking about
right, exactly. It should be big
size.
Enough. But I don't know if it should be no, not necessarily a kilometer, but I mean it's something between Planck scale and the size of the black hole. So I'm not sure what the scale it would be.
But that's a lot of matter, right? To make matter optically thick to neutrinos, I think the typical equation disk tends to be fairly optically thin. In fact,
that's right. That's right.
Neutrinos.
Yeah.
So in what picture?
But firewall is Planckian. I mean, nominally some Planck density object, right?
That's a Planck scale thick, though. Sure. I mean, there's a layer perhaps below the Planck scale above the black hole where all kinds of things happen. But that's not what you're thinking about. You're not talking about a Planck layer in which you have Fermi acceleration. You're talking about a macroscopic atmosphere.
Right, but I mean, there is a lot of space between the size of accretion disk and the Planck length. So, I mean, so the example is where supernovae are optically thick to neutrinos, or kind of marginally. So it's not that it's a terribly high density. You could get densities, nuclear densities, basically, and then that would be optically thick to neutrinos.
The scale of the core. Supernova is also a lot bigger than I think what we're talking about here.
That's right.
There is some potential issues where as soon as you have a pressure-supported atmosphere that has sufficiently energetic particles, you know, electrons or something, I guess maybe ions, to upscatter your neutrinos, then it will be low enough density that it won't be optically thick. But on the other hand, you know, we're talking about crazy stuff already. A little firewall here that's somehow supporting material, and if you believe amps, right? I don't think the firewall is a thermal spectrum, right? I mean, it's ordered unity occupation number on all modes down there. So, you know, we can appeal to Fermi acceleration because, as astrophysicists, we all heard this before. It's a natural way to produce a power law spectrum. But at this point, why would you need to do that necessarily? You just say, you know, once we
Well, I think if you want the 2-point sleep to be a prediction,
then
I would have said, well, that's a prediction because you have actually a hard mirror with a perfection coefficient that gives you 2-point sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're saying that, well, I mean, fine, it's like it's in the AGN, you say, oh, you know, anything can come out of that, I would say, okay, then
the Fermi acceleration doesn't actually have too much of a range for this power. So, I mean, you could go
but I'm saying, but it does require, because optical depth depends only on surface density, which for a neutron star collapse, by the way, that nuclear path isn't tiny, tiny, it's, you know, it's a few meters or something in, at nuclear densities.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to reflect any neutrino, you need the meters worth of nuclear matter before the neutrino will turn around again.
That's right. Yep.
And to have a meters worth of atmosphere, that's macroscopic about a black hole. That I think also as I know.
Okay, so meter and macroscopic. I'm happy with meter being macroscopic. Yeah. So
yeah,
I'm
that's fine. If you have a meter, you know,
okay.
A meter size
good. Meter
around
good.
It, no, which is what we need in order for you neutrinos to actually reflect back again to even talk about the Fermi
mm-hmm.
process. Then I think
right.
that does have other implications.
Good, perfect. That's why I'm giving talking about it.
Like just, I mean, we could take away the messages that fireballs potentially would affect the spectrum of neutrinos we see, like, but it would be very model dependent, like AGN.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a good way to sum this up. Shall I move on? Perfect. Thank you. So, there is something else that's, so the importance of this is that this is something that may sound crazy, but it's something that's testable. So if we, so the job is on us as astrophysicists to try to model this better, but the Fermi acceleration is something else, what is the structure of the atmosphere, how does the radiative transfer work, and see whether this actually can work or not. It's, what we've shown here is that energetics might be in our favor. So another topic that I'm going to mention briefly is that there's something interesting about fireballs, something that we noticed, actually my student Mehdi noticed a couple of years ago, is that in fact, if you want to find the equation of a state for fireballs, and fireball here, I mean, if you just have a membrane that sits right outside the horizon, and then the space-time ends there, the classical space-time ends there. So if you apply Israel junction condition positive to symmetry to that surface and to that membrane, and of course, if you say classical space-time ends, are you allowed to do this? That's a good question.
When you say ends, you just mean, what do you mean?
It's orbifolded.
So this is just a hard, this is just a GD's, hard GD's to the incomplete surface?
That's right.
Okay.
So what you can show is that this membrane has vanishing surface density, I mean, just to satisfy these conditions. But it has not vanishing pressure. Its pressure is, in fact, only temperature divided by 4. And if you just divide 1, well, pressure by temperature, which should give you entropy per unit area, it's just 1/4, which is what Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is. So, I mean, you can just view this as a different derivation of Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, but it tells you something interesting. It tells you that you can just think about the entropy of a black hole as the entropy of this membrane, and this membrane can satisfy Einstein equations, Israel junction condition, and a standard thermodynamics, that is the surface pressure plus density, which is 0, divided by temperature is just 1/4. So that tells us something interesting about the fireballs, that they should be incompressible, that, because the pressure is much bigger than the density. And that's going to come back to us. I mean, if you believe this line of argument, that's going to come back if you want to do cosmology with fireballs or cosmology with this approach to quantum gravity.
Does it matter where the stretched horizon is?
It should be very close. The closer it is to the horizon, the smaller is the surface density.
If a static solution, no matter where you put it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's you can always, this is not weird, right? You can always, whatever metric you design, you can come up with a matter that supports that, right?
I thought we're talking about Schwarzschild here.
Right, but Schwarzschild is, of course, vacuum, but we are cutting off the Schwarzschild. And now we're talking about the type of membrane that could sit there statically. And it would have a pressure and it would have a density, and by symmetry, that's the only thing you could have. And as I was saying, as it approaches the horizon, the surface density is much smaller than pressure.
So the pressure diverges as you approach the prime.
Absolutely. And this is actually related to this, all this works by Strominger and company that say basically you have this duality between compressible fluid mechanics right outside the horizon.
That's just saying you have a balloon that you a double layer balloon that confines some gas between it,
mm-hmm.
and you have to make it smaller and smaller. And if it has the right equation of state, then the pressure can always balance the gravity. And when it just happens to reach, if you want the equation of state to get to allow you to shrink
right.
statically to the Schwarzschild solution, you get this presumably.
It's a bit subtle because there's something about pressure cannot be isotropic. So if you just think about gas within a balloon, that may not be the right approach. So I haven't actually been able to find this from a limit of any smooth solution. I don't think there is a
limit.
Right. Okay. No, you could. No, you can violate for with isotropic pressure. You cannot do it. With anisotropic pressure, you can get anything you want. Right. That's been my experience. That. I think you can even prove a theory that with isotropic pressure you cannot build something like this. Okay, so there's something interesting. If you believe that there is this incompressible phase of quantum gravity, fireballs are really made out of some exotic phase of matter which has pressure much bigger than density. In fact, you can get back to the Big Bang, which is where we started from, and show that you could get the right properties for cosmology. In fact, this is something that was shown by McGuage a few years ago, that if you have an abrupt thermal phase transition in the speed of sound, that means that the speed of sound drops very suddenly from some very large number to one. And this is, so that means CS goes as 8, whereas A is a scale factor to the power of minus beta, where this beta is very big. Then you can get a scale invariant in the spectrum of fluctuations. And so this is something we worked at exactly. So this is how it looks like. It's proportional to the temperature of the phase transition to the power of 3 divided by M Planck. And then there are some dependence on these other parameters. So this is the scale invariant power spectrum. And in fact, if the bigger the beta, the closer you are to a scale invariance, the fact that Planck claims that there is some deviation from a scale invariance tells you that gives you actually a measurement of beta, how fast this transition should happen. So beta is close to 100. And the temperature, you could work it out from Planck observations. It's something of order the Gotthard scale. So this is the temperature. And this is the picture that we have. In fact, we even have a prediction for tensor to scalar ratio if you couple this theory to Hojava-Lifshitz gravity. That says tensor to the scalar ratio should be bigger than 10 to the minus 3. So we can.
So recombination beta is about 100 or so, right? So, and then you're saying the effect from recombination is just suppressed by Px over Mp, so that you say about 10 to the minus cubed, 10 minus.
At recombination, beta is 100. That's an interesting. Yeah, I never thought about that. So.
So you get about T over M Planck, which is an EV over 10 to the 19.
So that's going to be a smaller effect in addition to this, right? So,
sure, but you'd say there is, at least by this formula.
Yeah, this can be applied to your combination, I think. Yeah, I mean, I haven't thought about it that way. It's a tiny effect, so it's not that it's going to be observable, but I think it's there. Well, okay, so I think there are some considerations. So I should think about, I haven't thought about recombination.
So you're saying producing a scale invariant at
recombination
with the
speed up, because you have photons decoupled from baryons, right? So you have a speed up sound, the squared is 1/3, but suddenly drops to some small value. So that's right. So maybe this is some early time recombination phase, right? I don't know. That's interesting, but I haven't thought about that. That's
does
a good.
Power?
No, for recombination, because the temperature of recombination is an electron volt, so this is going to be tiny.
Yeah.
So this is the picture you get, in fact, for a co-moving sound horizon. So this is the acoustic history. You've heard about the expansion history of the universe. This is the acoustic history of the universe. In this. So this is what you get for the co-moving sound horizon as a function of temperature in a standard cosmology, this curve. So what we require is that this thing drops very, very quickly at some point when the temperature was about Gotthard scale, 10 to the 15 GeV. And these are the observable scales. So this does what inflation does for you as well. the modes exit the horizon, but here you're talking about the sun horizon, not light horizon. And then re-enter now, and it turns out that if this is abrupt enough and the initial condition is thermal, with the right temperature, then you can match basically all the observations. So one thing that we discovered in the course of this is, in fact, this is not the whole picture, because if you have a thermal spectrum here, at some point the fluctuations become so big on a small scale that you form primordial black holes. So there is, in fact, a bottom here. This must bottom out, or otherwise you're going to form lots of primordial black holes. So the simple picture of this dropping and to one instantly doesn't work. It actually has to drop to a smaller number, and then kind of plateau, evolve smoothly until it matches the standard cosmology. Otherwise, you form lots of primordial black holes. And as it turns out, this scale happens to be around the scale of QCD phase transition. So that leads to an interesting prediction that maybe if you have a QCD plasma, you should start to see, so this is like around 300 MeV, you should start to see these effects if these are, if this is a thermal effect, if the speed of sun is really something that could be bigger than one as a function of temperature. So that's suggestive. It's not a proof of any form, but this really requires is a microscopic theory. Because at the level that it is, it's just a theory for linear perturbations or quadratic action or linear perturbations around FRW. But the macroscopic theory doesn't exist to see whether actually what effect you expect to see at QCD phase transition. Okay, so any questions? So I guess I come back here that it seems that there are two lines of evidence that suggest point in the same direction. That there is a phase of quantum gravity, which is incompressible, the speed of sun is much bigger than one, temperatures around Gauss scale, and that could be how you hold the fireball outside the horizon, and could be something that's responsible for generational fluctuations in the early universe.
And this is the black hole lower limit business. So if your NS is less than one, then there's no divergence at small scale, so you don't form any black holes, isn't it?
Divergence is always there, and it has to do with the fact that the thermal spectrum doesn't remain thermal all along. Because the thermal spectrum, it's if you think about bosons at the small energies, it goes as 1/E, but then it becomes basically turns to vacuum fluctuations at large above the temperature, and it turns out that vacuum fluctuations always dominate. So the way this looks like is, so this is just Bose-Einstein distribution, right? But the thing is that vacuum fluctuation, that adds the 1/2 effectively here. So your spectrum that leads to a scale invariant is always like this, right? But it always plateaus. This means that the zeta spectrum is constant, but then it shoots up as a function of k. And this happens at the scale of the temperature. So that's the problem, is that if you're doing it the thermal spectrum is only a scale invariant in the Rayleigh-Jeans limit, in the Rayleigh-Jeans regime. And then in the Wien regime, the vacuum fluctuations dominate, and that's not a scale invariant. That's very blue. And those are the things that's responsible for primordial vacuum formation. So I had a third topic, but I, in the view of time, I'm not going to talk about that. I can show you some cool pictures. Okay, it has to do. You can read about it, and it has to do with whether Big Bang was like a supernova explosion. So we had somehow people got interested in this, and Scientific American wrote an article about it. So they have lots of cool graphics if you want to look them up. Let's see, another graphic I want to show is this. That's quite cool. So it doesn't have much to do with everything else I've talked about. So you can read about it, as I said, in the paper. But it has to do with a five-dimensional star collapsing, and out of that, if you have a supernova explosion in five dimensions, and out of that comes out our universe. So there's lots of cool graphics, and we have some arguments that support this. But in view of time, I'm not gonna have And we have a, we have another, we have also a prediction for a scaling invariant fluctuations as well. Okay, so let me just skip to the last slide. So it's a very subjective perspective, and it has to do with the recent developments in quantum gravity and cosmology over the past few years, the past couple of decades. And it seems that there seems to be some emergence of these different directions that all have something in common, that an incompressible phase of quantum gravity at temperatures of around GOTS, 10 to the 15 GeV, could do a bunch of things. I didn't talk much about UV completion, but this is, some of you might have heard about Ojala-Lipschitz gravity, that at high energies, omega goes as k cubed in your dispersion relation. So basically, a speed of gravitons, gravitons goes to infinity. That's Ojala-Lipschitz gravity. Let me just write it down. This is Ojala's proposal. So a speed of sound or a speed of propagation goes to infinity at large energies. So that's one, basically, that's the first emergence of incompressibility. Seems that you can get the properties of Big Bang right. That is, you can solve the horizon problem and get primordial scalar modes from a similar phase. And there are predictions for tensor modes and possibly superluminal QCD plasma that could be tested in the laboratory. And there are implications for firewalls. So you can, from this picture, you can get black hole entropy or firewall entropy with the right, basically, fours and g's factors. And there could be potential implications for PEB neutrinos and even dark energy, which I didn't talk much about. I'd be happy to talk to you about it in private. And I guess this last part I didn't really get time to talk about. But I'd be happy to talk to you. Of course, you know where to find me about this. Thank you.
Questions for that?
Yes.
What do you mean by the superluminal QCD plasma?
So this is, it's not quite clear, but this is something that you require for this model to work. This basically, I've said, one of the predictions of this model. That, as I said, if you want to avoid primordial black hole production, your sand horizon needs to be bigger than the standard one, up to basically, this needs to become flat at the level that only approaches the standard Big Bang value at temperature of what QCD phase transition.
Does that mean if I have a heavy ion collision and I make a QCD plasma, then some crazy structures happen?
Yes.
Then why would we see
it?
Well, I don't know what we should see.
This is what Rick is all about.
It is what Rick is all about. But then, I mean, this is a strongly correlated phase. So I don't know this is something we learn. So when we learn how this phase works by studying Rick. But then exactly what you expect to see, I'm not sure. So this could be, so maybe it's just above Rick. So I think this is, like many other things that I mentioned here, this is something that is in need of a good model. And the model that's here is not a model for Rick, it's the model for cosmology. It says that for this to work, something funny should happen here. You could, one way to interpret it is that since you haven't simulated Rick, this must be ruled out. Except that I don't actually have a prediction for Rick, so I'm not sure what Rick must have seen. I don't know. So if we can make a prediction in the context of this model, then that's something that one can go and look for and see whether it's ruled out.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.